Dalton's Comics and Culture Radar, a podcast that's on the lookout for what's good to read and watch. If you don't know who Milton is, let's ask Kiefer Sutherland's father what he thinks.
Don't write this down, but I find Milton probably as boring as you find Milton. He's a little bit long-winded. He doesn't translate very well into our generation, and his jokes are terrible.
This episode, Milton's guest is Dave Chisholm. Dave is the writer and artist of the upcoming graphic novel Chasing the Bird, Charlie Parker in California. Dave is also a musician and educator. He is also the artist of Thompson Heller, Detective Interstellar, which he collaborated on with Milton.
Dave, thank you for coming on to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Milton. I'm really excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you on because one of the things, or the most important thing we're here to talk about today, is a book that I've had the privilege of seeing every page as it was in development, and it is finally here. And I'm talking about Chasing the Bird, Charlie Parker in California. Why don't you give us a quick elevator pitch about the book?
Sure. Well, Charlie Parker, it's a book that was written in to commemorate Charlie Parker's 100th birthday. And for those of you who don't know, Charlie Parker is a famous jazz saxophonist who lived fast and died tragically pretty young. And he was mainly active as an artist in the 1940s and 1950s. And so the book was commissioned by his family estate, the people who manage the Charlie Parker estate. It was published by Z2 Comics, and the book, it really focuses on a particularly tumultuous time in his life when he lived in California for a couple years. And the way the story is constructed is as a series of vignettes, each one narrated by a different person whose life intersected with Charlie's during this particular stretch of time. And I'm just so thrilled with the way this book turned out. I can't wait for everybody to read it. I think people are really gonna love this book, even if they're not music fans or jazz fans. I think the scope of the book is a little bit beyond that for anyone could pick this up and get something from it. So
that is absolutely true. But on the creation side of the book, you bring something to the table that separates you from other comic creators that's directly relevant. And that is, you are not just a jazz aficionado or knowledgeable person. You actually even are a jazz musician. So if anyone is listening to this that's not familiar with your musical pedigree, tell us real quickly your other area of interest outside of comics.
Yeah. I have 3 degrees in jazz music, including my doctorate from the Eastman School of Music in Rochester, New York, where I live, which is one of the best music schools in the world. And on top of those 3 degrees, I have, how old am I now? I have like over 20 years of professional experience playing music, including gigs. Like, I, played at the Umbria Jazz Festival in Italy, and I've played in, overseas in China, and I had a weird series of concerts in Estonia at one point, music and comics really are always competing for my obsession and attention. This is real kismet that this happened. I'm lucky enough to have had the time and energy, to pursue my obsessions to like the highest degree possible. And this particular project really was a perfect combination of those obsessions into this like lovely book. So yeah, I'm a lucky guy.
Yeah, you were definitely at the right place in the right time. opportunity came around, and you were the right choice for the estate to do this. I do have one very kind of key question about the format of the book. As you said, it's structured in a series of vignettes. But even beyond being structured in a series of vignettes, each vignette is told from a different person's point of view. And these people don't necessarily agree. They don't necessarily paint a consistent picture. There's a bit of a Rashomon-like quality to this story. And I'm curious, was that a narrative choice that you made, or is that just kind of inherent in anybody that's entering the world of Charlie Parker?
That's a great question. I think that the answer is maybe a little bit of both. Charlie Parker.
No, you got to pick one. Darn it. Not
Charlie Parker is this legendary mythological figure in jazz. And he kind of like hit at the perfect time where just enough of his life was captured and so much of his music is recorded. But like, there's still an air of like mystery and legend around him. And he's one of these figures who lived such a large life with a tremendous appetites in every way that there's a lot of like myth building around his existence that is undeniable. And so, from moment zero, from the very first moment, I wanted that legend to factor into the story in some way. And the fact that like legend doesn't necessarily match up with like factual reality, and I wanted to lean into that. And so pretty quickly it became like you said, like a Rashomon thing where you're getting a lot of people's point of view of this man. And you know, when I spoke with the estate people in the very first conversation we had, they were like, well, we don't want this book to be a boring documentary. And thankfully I didn't want to draw that either. I'm sure those graphic novels can be good to read, but I didn't really feel like making a kind of like heavily narrated documentary style kind of Ken Burns does Charlie Parker graphic novel. I wanted it to be a little more dynamic, a little more fun, and a little more leaning into the myth that does exist around Charlie Parker. And then also allowing me to kind of like flex a little bit in terms of the comics visual vocabulary and storytelling vocabulary in order to like make each chapter, the storytelling and visual style, really crafted to depict the biases and points of views of each of the respective narrators.
Yeah. One of the sort of, I hate to go hyperbolic here, but I mean, almost damn near miraculous aspects of this book is you have managed to make a graphic novel sing. You have managed to make music itself be an element in the story. And I think you maybe arrived at this kind of maybe cumulatively through some of your other music-related projects. But with this book in particular, you've kind of invented a visual grammar to where people reading this book also kind of hear the music in a weird way. Was that something you really wanted to try to break ground on? Did it just sort of happen? How did that come about?
Yeah. Well, thanks for the kind words, Milton. I appreciate it very much. Well, first I'll say that, I looked at it as like my responsibility here with this project, that like you, I, I as like a musician who's like a musically literate person, I feel like one of my responsibilities with a project like this, since I knew it was going to be my highest profile book, like that I'll have done to date, maybe ever, that my responsibility was to kind of like help like explain, even if it's in some kind of like guttural, like visual, I guess to educate people in some meaningful way about like what makes Charlie Parker's music special. And even, like I said, even if it's in a way that's like not like follow the bouncing ball and you can like understand what's going on with Charlie Parker, or like here's what's happening in Measure Five or something like that, but more like on a kind of gut level where the music is like incorporated into the book and on a more like structural fabric that will help people understand Parker. So like sort of like so like to tell the story, I felt like it was my responsibility to really try to bridge that gap. I'm in a unique position where like I have the chops to make the comic, and I have the musical chops to kind of teach it. And I teach music, like that's like one of my jobs that I have, is I'm a music teacher. And so with that, and finding a way to thread that needle without being overly pedantic, to make so people didn't feel like I was talking, like lecturing at them about music theory or something like that. And the estate didn't want that either. And so, and then on another level, this idea of like bridging the gap between music and comics is definitely a longstanding obsession of mine. My 2017 graphic novel Instrumental came with a soundtrack of music that went with it. And I teach a class at RIT, Rochester Institute of Technology, called Comics and Music, where my students make comics based on music, and with a real emphasis on formalism and structural kind of the structural aspects at play in each of these respective types of media. And so this is an obsession of mine. And I felt like, so like add that obsession into like the fact that I felt responsible to help like educate people on some level about like Charlie Parker's music. And this is what came out. Yeah, man, I'm really happy with the way it turned out on that level. I think it was a real conscious decision, and I think it turned out good. The other thing is that I have to add is that the way it's structured, being told through as a series of vignettes, each one in a different style, allowed me also to explore a few different ways of depicting music on the page. So it was nice because I didn't have to necessarily commit to one particular way. I could explore a variety of ways, which, you know, again, gives the variety of readers with all of their different types of musical experience or lack of musical experience as many inroads as possible.
You don't have to be so politically correct about it. I represent that side of the audience. Unwashed, musically illiterate masses. Just call them the Miltons.
yes, all the Miltons of the world. I wanted to give as many inroads as possible so that like people who are musically literate could look at it and be like, oh, this is actually the solo that Charlie played when at this party at Zorthian's ranch. And these are the actual notes that he played flowing out of his saxophone. Or when they go to the Dizzy chapter, they're like, oh, they can get it based on what those like neon like squares and geometric shapes that are coming out of the instruments. And then, you know, like throughout the book, all of these different ways of like depicting music kind of make themselves known.
Now, if I recall correctly, the part that you talked about threading the needle, and I'll go ahead and insert the most obviously terrible cliche here, hitting the right note on, which is finding that sweet spot of balancing your responsibility to this grand story, your desire as an educator and a musical teacher to convey this to a broad audience, but also on the other side, not going too far and not getting overly lecturally.
Mm-hmm.
If I recall correctly, in the earliest phases of birthing it, you had a couple of cycles of figuring that out before you arrived at that sweet spot. Can you remember like any kind of general principles, or was it more of a gut feel going to various extremes before you arrived at the right happy medium? How did you satisfy yourself on those competing interests?
Gosh, that's a good question, and I don't know if I have a good answer. I think just like, to be honest, Milton, I think for this particular book, I went with my gut from like mm-hmm. moment one, and at one point in the scripting, the estate people, the only piece of feedback that I got in that early phase was like pretty early on, and they were like, don't be careful not to put too much musical jargon in the book. And so I took that note and I was like, okay, duly noted. And that, and it allowed, kind of gave me like you know, a chance to play like the teaching a music appreciation class. Like, how many ways can you look at, like, how many ways can you explain organically what's happening in a piece of music by Charlie Parker, or, you know, like J.S. Bach or whoever, and explain it to like all the Miltons of the world, in a way that's not going to make them feel like stupid, you know?
Yeah. You managed to, you hit that note perfectly, honestly, because I felt that I learned a ton, not just about this one particular musician who's obviously of enormous importance, but just jazz history in general. One other thing that you did that seems, now I may be totally wrong on this, but one thing that feels totally authentic throughout the book is it conveys a sense of a time and place really well. It feels of the era. And I'm wondering, you know, the important moments in this story are what, like 80 years ago. So how did you manage to bring that period to life visually?
Oh, man. Well, I would say that, like, that's very kind of you to say. I'm sure that people who are like real obsessive aficionados of like 1940s and early 1950s, like American culture, will probably look at this and be like, hey, like this person is dressed in a way that's like 10 years too late or 10 years too early. And so with regards to like the way that people talk, I read a lot of interviews. I found as much as I could find by each of the narrators and tried my best to capture their voice in as authentic a way as possible without like, with a way that still gave me freedom to like be creative and kind of let the characters breathe on the page. Honestly, I would say that like probably some of the conversations in the book surrounding the topic of race are probably much more contemporary than any conversation that happened. It probably those conversations are more at home in like a 2020 world than they are in a 1949 world. So, you know, I walked into that knowing full and well what I was doing. It wasn't I don't think it's not accidental. It's more like writing, finding that balance between being authentic to the era, but also writing for like a contemporary audience, in a way that's going to communicate the ideas that need to be communicated effectively. So like not just thinking about, you know, just purely about being authentic, but also thinking about finding a way that's going to land with readers in the present day and forward. So yeah, man, I mean, but then on top of that, like there's a lot of research, you know, a ton of like for a while, you know, I work with like my laptop open next to me and I probably had like 200 tabs open in my like internet browser that were all just like reference photos of like places and cars and interiors and stuff like that, like furniture and stuff like that from the time. And just having that stuff open all the time. I mean, yeah, that's about it. Just pretty typical stuff. We live in an amazing time to do kind of period work like this, because we have Google image search to help us out. Although if you can always believe it too, maybe sometimes Google lies. I don't know.
right. So we've talked about some of the challenges in this book already. There's the challenge of conveying music itself on a page. There's the challenge of having multiple narrators that don't necessarily agree. There's the challenge of dealing with racial topics removed from a time period. There's the challenge of the time period itself. There's the legendary aspect of Parker and the importance of getting those details right. And then there's another one that I would like to ask you about, which is your subject in this book is a person who dealt with addiction, and the addiction is a very important component of the story. But to your credit, it does not overwhelm the story in any respect. And I often feel that this is a mistake that a lot of filmmakers or biographers or graphic novelists who take on a topic of this, when that dimension is brought into a story, it can easily overwhelm and reduce that person mm-hmm. into being that's their entire existence, that they are an addict.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And how did you manage dealing with that very sensitive and difficult terrain?
Well, again, like I would say probably the angles that I think I'm really, really benefit from a 2020 point of view on addiction. The current discourse around addiction is very different now than it was, you know, than it was in like 1945 or whatever, 49. So it's like, or even just like 10 years ago, I mean, it's different. So like, it's always unfolding the way we kind of understand this and the way we frame it, the ways in which we frame it like socially. And so, and you know, that what you're saying is really holds true. I think for a lot of like media, when you see like a gay character in a piece of media, that becomes the overwhelming, you know, that their like whole character arc is going to be about their like gayness. Or if you have a character who's like black in a piece of media, like how often do we see black media that is just only centered around like black misery and black grief? And yeah, there's sadly like too much of like a disproportionately high amount of that historically and in the present day. But like, it's powerful to recognize that like your subjects in a story have many dimensions. So like, just because you have a character who's like Korean American, the story doesn't need to be about their Korean Americanness. Just because you have a story about an addict doesn't mean the entire story has to revolve around their afflictions and addictions. And so, like, you know, with this, that said, like, when you look at when you really kind of examine and put all the pieces out for Charlie's life in kind of a honest way, and you look at all the pieces, you realize that, like, the part of him, or at least maybe this is my point of view. I don't think I come down definitively in the book. That's another advantage of, like, having this vignette style, is it kind of allows me as the author to present a lot of points of view without ever staking my claim on any one of them. Which, you know, is kind of, I guess, how I live my life a lot. But anyway, that's a different story. And so, like, with when I look at all the pieces of Charlie Parker's life, and you look at it honestly, you can see that, like, the part of him that addicted to heroin and alcohol, and he had, like, a food addiction and would just eat enormous quantities of food, just binge like crazy. And he was very, like, promiscuous sexually and not great at relationships, and basically was, like, nowadays maybe we would call him, like, a sex addict or something like that as well. But you can also see that, like, if that part of him didn't exist, probably the musician that we know and love, and that the musician that truly, like, changed the landscape for music in the world in, like, a short career, he died at age 34, that he wouldn't have made that music, because his obsessive side is exactly what pushed him to, like, practice for, like, 16 hours a day and to kind of break all these boundaries and push himself to the point that, like, he's like beyond virtuoso kind of genius level improviser and musician. And so you know, and you'll find that if you examine the people in your life, the it's really common, maybe this is just something I've noticed with people, but the part of them that you love and admire the most has a dark side to it, right? So if you love someone because they're so driven and they're so determined and they're so focused, that person is probably miserable to be in a relationship with, because they're, like, never totally there with you. They always have their thing that they're determined on in their mind, right? So it's the same thing that you love about them becomes the thing that you hate. Or, like, if you love that someone, if you love that someone is, like, a free spirit and adventurous, you know, that person will probably break your heart at some point because of that free spiritedness, right? Or yeah. if you love that someone has, like, the biggest heart or whatever, and is a really sensitive person, that, you know, then that can be probably lead to some conflict later on, or, you know. And so when you look at a person like Charlie, like, in a bigger picture, you could say that, like, all the obsession that we love about him can't be separated from the obsession that we hate about him, that breaks our hearts about him. And it's really a picture of humanity. You know, this is, like, the things we love about humanity it's the exact same things that we hate about humanity. Not to get too poetic about my book or something like that. This is not so much about my book or my depiction of Charlie, but just more like an observation. And you know, the thing that's fascinating about Charlie's story is that he would just take people at face value from the sound of it. And he sounds like someone who was just genuinely curious and genuinely exploring. And again, this is, like, this can tie into someone's life in a negative way, not just, like, in a way that's like, oh, what a great curious person, but also, like, curious people probably take more risks than people who aren't curious. Right. But as a result, you see someone who showed up on Earth for, like, a short amount of time and changed everything. And then when you look at the structure of the book, this is exactly what he does for all of these people who are narrating the book. Like, he shows up into their life for like a day or an afternoon or a weekend or like a couple of months, and he changes their life forever in a short span of time. And, you know, it was definitely deliberate that I structured it this way, because this is how Charlie's life impacted music and the world. So yeah, man, pretty long-winded answer there. Sorry.
No, that was a fascinating answer. I really appreciate it. And every aspect of talking about this book is fascinating to me. And I think you really, from a comic creator point of view and a musician point of view, delivered your all, gave your all, and it's clearly evident on the page. And I also got to say, it seems like the publisher has also delivered their all, and the actual product itself is exquisitely packaged. You've got a very high profile foreword. There are a couple of very attractive different editions. Then in addition to the publisher, there's sort of a simultaneous series of other things around the centennial. Why don't you tell us a little bit about some of those things?
Yeah. Well, starting with the foreword, I was just super thrilled and amazed and honored to find out that Kareem Abdul-Jabbar wrote the foreword. And Kareem is like a towering figure, and he's the perfect guy because he's like a huge jazz head. In particular, he's a scholar on the jazz scene, the history of the jazz scene in Los Angeles, where the story takes place. So like, he had an article in like the LA Times about LA's jazz scene in the 1940s and 1950s, like a couple months ago, which is like completely makes him just like the perfect person for this. And he wrote this foreword, and it's the most powerful, like it's a huge honor. Like, I can't even explain. It's just a huge honor. And then Z2, yeah, like Z2, the book is in two, there's two editions. They're both hardcover editions. And there's a standard edition that's a standard graphic novel size. And it looks awesome. The paper is really nice quality paper. All that stuff that us like book kind of bibliophiles love. And then there's the deluxe edition, which is limited to 1,500 copies, and it's a little more expensive. The standard is $25 and the deluxe is $100, but it's oversized. It's humongous. It's like 14 inches tall, whereas a typical comic, I think, is about 10 inches tall or something like that. It's much bigger, and it has a slipcase that it comes in that's beautiful. With like a die cut, like a cutout for the title, the circular title logo to shine through. And then it comes with some art prints, and all of it comes with a record too. Actually, every version of it comes with a vinyl. I'm not sure if the deluxe one comes with a different vinyl. I guess I should know that, but I don't. But it's a vinyl record with some of Charlie, previously unreleased Charlie Parker recordings from his time in Los Angeles. Now I know the Bird people, the Charlie Parker people, had plans, really big, ambitious plans for his centennial, which were unfortunately hijacked by COVID-19, which is like just the story everywhere for everything. Unfortunately, we're still in the midst of that, like, complete disaster. But there's some more stuff that's coming around the bend. There's an album of music called Bird in LA that captures a lot of the same moments that I capture in the book. And the liner notes for that, I've actually had the privilege of being able to read those liner notes, because it doesn't come out until I think the first quarter of 2021. But the liner notes on it are super fascinating and cover a lot of the same events that I cover, but from that very top-down, like documentary point of view. So it kind of doesn't have the same like mythological aspect that I bring to the table, but in a funny way, it reads like a fact check of my book, you know? so it's pretty, it's, I mean, truly, you know, as someone who's like lived and breathed jazz music for so much of my life, this is, I have to pinch myself. It's like the biggest honor to be able to be given this responsibility to tell this story. I can't even understate how huge this is.
So, you mentioned the pandemic, which is obviously the number one topic on all of our minds at the moment. We're recording this on the 22nd of November. It's probably going to post maybe about 10 days after we record it or whatever. And, due to the pandemic, I don't even know the answer to this question yet. Is the book in stores yet?
You know, I think there was a problem at Diamond somehow regarding their inventory of this book, their shipment or stock of this book. I'm not sure what exactly went wrong, or if it's still wrong. But I know, like, as far as I know, the book is getting, I think the first stock that was at Amazon, like, was shipped off, like, really quickly. And it was like, they found themselves without stock, like immediately. And, I think they maybe like underestimated the amount they needed to pre-order. Again, I don't know how the mechanics of this work. So, but I do know that like the book is in warehouse in America. Like you can definitely get it from Z2. As far as comic shops go, like I should have answers. Hopefully that we have answers by the time this podcast airs. I'm anticipating some kind of answer this week about that. And I've also been told that the book is in stock at for Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com as well. Just that maybe they're like online, like it gets in stock and it takes a minute for their websites to catch up to what's actually in stock. So that's about as far as I am in this stuff. It's tricky. I mean, I wish I had a better answer for you, Milton.
Well, I mean, this is the world we're living in right now. Due to the pandemic, we just don't know. But I can give you direct reports myself. A couple of my friends that ordered the hardcover edition received theirs a few days ago. I personally ordered the deluxe edition, and according to the tracking on USPS, it's going to arrive tomorrow, the 23rd. So nice. I'm ecstatic about that. It's kind of weird that this key moment in the release, you know, is not as obvious and singular as it is for most books, but this is the world we live in. And I want to talk about the world we live in 2020. You mentioned that 2020 gave you some advantages in, you know, having access to instant, reference photography for this period book. It gave you added perspective on topics such as addiction and race. But, you know, 2020 itself is a fucking clusterfire. And I've got to imagine, you know, everybody's got their challenges with the year. I've got to assume for you, it's been a struggle in the sense that, you know, we've talked about the fact that you're a musician and you're normally a gigging musician, and you probably have not been able to have gigs, and how that's affected your creative process and your overall feeling of energy and everything has got to just be a total scramble time.
Well, you know, man, first off, I'll say that like again, to echo my sentiments at the start of this conversation, like, I'm a lucky guy, really lucky. All my music teaching has remained intact. I just teach it via Zoom now. I still have the joy of teaching a college class, adjunct, you know. Yeah, my gigs have gone away, but like, really that void has been filled with more like paid, like comics work. I took a ton of commissions earlier this year, and I've moved on to my next book at this point. And, so in a way, like, for people who are purely, who aren't like kind of polymath freaks like me, it's been a lot harder. I do have, like, most of my friends are gigging musicians, and I know that it's been really, like, existentially and also financially difficult for a lot of them, and it really sucks. Not to mention that, like, people are also catching COVID-19 and, like, getting really sick and dying. So, like, that hasn't happened to me yet, so I'm really lucky, right? The first thing I always do is kind of count my blessings before I launch into, like, my complain session. I think the biggest thing that I could complain about 2020 is the fact that all of the pomp and circumstance that was supposed to be around the release of this book and Canopus, my sci-fi book that came out earlier this year, has basically been, like, deflated, or at least just moved online, which doesn't feel as, like, it's not as fun as, like, getting, like, flying out to Los Angeles to do an event. Instead, I'm doing an event on Zoom. You know what I mean? It's kind of a drag. I'm, like, missing my big special moment, but all things considered, like, I got to make this book, and the book turned out awesome. So, like, I can't complain. The other thing is, I'm, like, kind of a introvert, like, shut in, you know, kind of guy. I tend to, like, work my best when I just shut myself in a room for, like, many, many hours at a time. And so this pandemic quarantine has honestly been really good for my productivity in that way. The other thing is, I kind of, like, work to kind of get my mind to silence my mind. So working on my whatever I'm working on, it just shuts that, like, ruminating, bleak, apocalyptic part of my mind in a nice way that results in me being more sane, and then also me having some cool comics at the end of it that have been made. And so and I mean, I miss gigging. I'm sure that'll be back, you know, once this, like, vaccine stuff happens, then the wedding gigs will come, and hopefully the people who used to hire me for wedding gigs will call me up again. We'll see.
Cool. Well, definitely. One thing you said resonated with me this year, in addition to your sci-fi epic Canopus and the newly arriving Charlie Parker book, you collaborated with me on Thompson Heller, Detective Interstellar.
Hell yeah.
Which had its quote unquote release a few weeks ago. And there were shipping issues with that one as well. And then we both had kind of a weird dance, because we both have these books due out. Originally, they were supposed to be months apart.
Mm-hmm.
And then things got delayed on the Parker side a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And then things got delayed on the Heller side. And so there was this back and forth. And then there was a moment where it almost seemed like they were both going to come out on the same day.
Yeah.
Which would have been weird. But I definitely feel you on you came up with the perfect word, deflating. Because, you know, we work on comic projects for a very, very long periods of time. Although the Charlie Parker book you did in a blizzard of fury compared to other comics, which was amazing in and of itself. Thompson Heller took a bit longer for a number of
well, yeah, you know, the for me, man, the reason Tom, we, because you and I made Thompson Heller, I want to say like 2015 through 2017 or something like that, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And the reason why it took me a lot longer to draw that is because when I was making Thompson Heller, I was like scrambling for work too, right? And I was drawing like three books at the same time for like, there was like a children's book that I was doing at the same time. There was Tyranny of the Muse, which is another book that I'm still currently working on. And I've been working on that with Eddie Wright, this great writer, for like years now, like 5 years we've been working on this book. And then your book, Thompson Heller, I was doing all three of those at the same time, trying to juggle between those three. And I gotta say, man, that period of time for me is like the period of biggest growth for me. So like part of it, like a huge part of that was drawing Thompson Heller was like a really great experience for me. So I just gotta say thanks again, Milton, for sticking with me during that, even though I went kind of slow.
It was fantastic, and I'm glad I accidentally through my crazy script writing put you in such a challenging spot. Once you emerge to the other side, you can view it as a quote unquote growth period. That was not, I don't think that was either of our intentions going in, but I'm glad it worked out that way. So I appreciate that. I guess I should ask you at least a couple of questions on Heller, but I don't have any because, you know, we worked on it together. I guess maybe just real quickly convey some of your experiences of illustrating Heller from your point of view, because I know what writing it was like. What was it like to draw it?
It was like, it was really fun to draw it, and I think that my work has, on some levels, has changed quite a bit since I drew that. I think my process has changed a fair amount, but like I also look back on those pages really fondly because there's like just a ton of energy on those pages, you know, like, and you know, like Milton, the ideas that are so like imaginative in the book. And so to like take those is my job, my responsibility to take those super imaginative ideas that you bring to the table and then put them on the paper in a way that like, you know, helps visually communicate these like paragraphs of like what's going on in it, you know? And so like on one hand, it was like stressful because it was quite, the scripts were quite hard to draw. But on the other hand, it was like super fun challenge. It gave me the chance to like, to take a stab at like some world building, visual kind of world building. That's like, all of us artists like want to be better and better at that. Like it's something that we like, most of our like legends in this field, like if there's one thing that binds them all together, it's this, like they make a world that like feels like fully realized, whether we're talking about Jack Kirby or like Mobius, more obvious people, or even someone like Jaime Hernandez, you know, like those Love and Rockets books feel like fully realized worlds. Right. And so not to compare myself to those guys, but like, it's kind of cool to like get a shot to have a visual world that's like, or worlds, I guess, because it takes place on a few different worlds, like build it all from the ground up. It's also a huge challenge, but it was really fun, man. So thank you again.
Well, you definitely knocked it out of the park, and I'm super thrilled that it's finally coming out. By the time this posts, issue 2 should be in stores. I'm particularly proud of all of them, but issue 3 is probably my favorite. And I think you did a wonderful job on that. There were aspects of issue 3 that were just damn near impossible to consider how to do. And you managed to bring them about. So I can't wait for people to see that. So I'm looking forward to that. But enough about our collaboration here. Let's move on to one other topic I like to ask comic creators. Do you have any big two Marvel or DC or otherwise licensed property comics that you would ever want to do? Do you have any dream gigs in that variety?
Man, you know, my answer is going to be probably a little bit like left of center. basically like my dream projects. I mean, look, I just to kind of echo like what Rick said. I mean, I grew up loving Spider-Man, and you know, I say this in every podcast I've recorded, but my mom to this day claims my first word was Spider-Man. And so, you know, I probably own more X-Men and Batman comics than anything else. Like truly, and I feel like my indie cred, if you look at my shelves, my indie cred probably kind of like stinks a little bit, you know? It's like, my tastes are probably a lot more mainstream than my published work conveys. But at the same time, my creative mind isn't really in that space, you know? I'm not really I don't really read Batman and think, "Oh, I have the perfect story for Batman," or read X-Men and think the same thing. Every time I imagine myself doing a story of these characters, it's just like a day in the life kind of stories, you know, where we see like Wolverine going to buy groceries or something like that. But I will say that, like, you know, I'm in this zone now where like I've kind of, you know, I do have some dreams of like doing licensed comics for like musicians and like bands and stuff like that. And I'll put this out there. One of my dreams would be to like to do, and this is like total, the most cliche, like nerdy, like white guy, you know, per stuff. But like, I would love to take like all of the music and lyrics of Radiohead's album, OK Computer, and like look at them and put them out, set them out on the table and craft a story that's like all encompassing for like that whole album. And then make that project. That's what I would like to do.
Well, it just so happens we have on the line Tom York. Tom, what do you... Nah, okay.
No, you actually no, got...
I think I that would
got,
be...
You accidentally got Tim York on the line. I think it's the wrong...
Oh, man. When you said that, for half a second, I thought that all my life I had had his name wrong. And his name... Okay, that was great. That was great. So, yeah, I think that would be amazing. I do think you would do an incredible Spider-Man. It would be Ditko-esque in the sense of not being an aping of Ditko's style, but it would have a singular signature Chisholm style that people would refer to and dig. And I hope Marvel one day has the cojones to do something like that. And I think that day will come. I really do. I hope so.
You know, it would be fun to do for a while. It would be a fun challenge. I would definitely, I feel like sometimes I doubt my own, like, I look at writers like you got, like you and Rick and, you know, some other friends and stuff, and they're like, yeah, I have like 50 pitches, like 50 stories that I could pitch. And I'm like, I have like a half of a story to pitch right now, you know? But then when I feel like when I'm given an opportunity, or when some opportunity comes knocking at my door, like this Charlie Parker thing, all of a sudden, like the doors of creativity, like fly open for me. So maybe if they were to approach me and be like, "Hey, do you want to do a Doctor Strange book?" Then all of a sudden, like, all of the cool ideas would come to me once it was a reality. But as it is right now, I'm not spending any energy planning anything you know, I'm not, yeah, that's not, it's not really part of my brain currently. Yeah.
Well, let's hope you get that challenge thrown at you. And speaking of future challenges, can you tease anything? I know you're working on something at the moment that you can't really talk about. Give us a high level sort of expectation of what's next for you.
Yeah, I'm working on another book. I've signed a contract for it, and
that's great, and that's all he can say. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. No,
it's another we'll say, just to, I'll be as specific as I can be, but which is pretty vague. It's another music related book, and I'm writing and drawing it, and I'm actually doing everything on this one, at this point, like the first three chapters of the script, the first 60 pages of script have been approved by editorial. And so I'm like off to the races on that. I'm about 20 pages in at this point, in terms of the finished art, and, the whole thing as of right now, the total page count for the script is 180 pages. So it's a little bit bigger than the Charlie Parker book, but yeah, it's going to be awesome, man. I can't wait till I can share about it, but I don't think that's going to be until well into 2021.
Right. Right. I can tell, folks that I've seen a little tiny, well, I don't even know if I can say that because, I saw stuff before you signed a contract. Let's say.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
But fans of the Charlie Parker book are going to be more than pleased, I think, with your follow up. So stay tuned, everyone. But definitely get the Charlie Parker book for now. And before we close out, I have a routine question I ask everyone: what's on your radar these days? What are you watching? What are you reading that you can recommend for us?
I knew you were going to ask this, and I'm like so unprepared for this question. I'm currently reading like the Grant Morrison Batman Omnibus. And I thought Blue and Green was really great. Another book that's like jazz tangential, kind of jazz related book that Image just put out. It's a very attractive book that everyone should check out. I just watched The Queen's Gambit on Netflix.
I hope you loved it as much as I did.
I have quite a bit of it that I'm critical of.
Uh-oh.
But that's a different conversation. I thought it was beautifully filmed. I appreciated the novel aspect of having a character who's a woman who just wins all the time. But yeah, you know, there were some aspects of it that I felt like left me a little bit like cold. And what else? This is the time of year when my wife and I just watch like tons of like crappy holiday movies and just like talk about how we would rewrite them or just kind of like brainstorm. She's an amazing editor. She maybe hates it when I say this, but I don't know. Maybe she likes it. She's a great editor. So like whenever we watch movies together, whether they're good or bad, we always have these amazing conversations afterwards about like what character moments felt unearned, and and it's especially funny to do that when you're watching like an all-time horrible Christmas movie. It's a good exercise in editing, I suppose.
Cool.
That's not a great list of things to recommend. I'm not recommending, honestly, many things at all. So I don't know. What am I reading? What else? I like you know, Once in Future is a great book that's coming out right now. That one always makes it. Thompson Heller is awesome. I also, my friend Caitlin Yarsky has a book that's coming out right now on Image called Bliss. And she's a fantastic artist. Definitely someone to keep your eyes on. She's just a beast. And then looking at my, I love Ginseng Roots, Craig Thompson's current monthly or bi-monthly book. What else am I checking out every month? I don't know, man. That's it right now. I mean, I buy a lot more than that, but just like everybody else, my stack of comics to read is like probably like over 1,000 at this point. I just am banking on maybe getting really sick one day and being bedridden.
Well, so, yeah. I think we've got a few to go on there. I appreciate it. I appreciate it.
Right on.
Well, thank you so much for having the time and coming onto the show. Before I let you go, remind folks how they can find you on the interwebs.
My website is davechisholmmusic.com. And then my Twitter handle is twitter.com/ChisholmDave. So it's like my last name and then my first name. And then on Instagram, I am the Dave Chisholm, like the Dave Chisholm. And then I have like a Facebook artist page that I rarely update called Dave Chisholm Music and Comics. But Facebook just sucks, man. It just sucks. Like you can't get traction if you don't pay for it.
Yeah, and of course, you know, we all had that time period where we all accepted every friend request that came our way just about, and some random person that you don't remember from college or high school somehow reached out to you, and then you know, at the time it didn't mean anything, but then, you know, 7 or 8 years later, you get reminded about their terrible political opinions on an hourly basis. And it's just a terrible platform. It's just really annoying.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true.
So on that sour note, we wish everyone goodbye and tell them to read all the fun books.
Yes.
Charlie Parker, Thompson Heller, etc.
Milton, thanks so much for having me, man. I really appreciate it.
All right, man. Thanks for coming on.
Take it easy.